came. Thanks so much for taking away the pain that I tried so hard to evade.
Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is January 9th, 2018, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Lidocaine for Renal Colic? And we have two, that's right, two guest skeptics. Dr. Tony Sapal is the chairman of the Department of Emergency Medicine at the University of Arkansas, and he's brought along one of his outstanding residents, Dr. Rachel Littlefield. She's a PGY2 in emergency medicine at the University of Arkansas. Welcome back to the SGEM, Tony.
Thanks, Ken. Always great to be back on the SGEM.
It has been too long, so give us just any kind of morsel of update to tell the listeners what is exciting happening down there in Arkansas right now.
It's warm, Ken.
Well,
it's warm.
You are speaking to a Canadian, so of course it's warm. It's all relative. It's like evidence-based medicine. It all depends.
Yeah, but it's warm.
It's always warmer there. All right, Rachel, how did Tony get you to do this episode? Was there some arm twisting involved?
Well, he's Tony Sapal, so if he asks, you just do.
Sir, yes, sir. Yes.
He jumps, you say how high. No.
Yeah, it's hard to say no to because he's such a nice guy. But I do need to point out that this article wasn't published in the last year, and we really like to cut that KT window down to less than 1 year. But we are going to cut that KT window down to less than 10 years. And the reason I really picked this paper out was because I've been seeing on Facebook and on a Twitter feed about people using lidocaine to treat renal colic. And I'm like, oh, okay. Naturally, I was skeptical. And I wanted to look, what's the evidence? What evidence could they be using for considering such a treatment? And because, Tony, you and I have talked about renal colic multiple times on the SGEM, I reached out to you as an expert on stones.
Yeah, you know, Ken, I guess this has become part of my niche at the SGEM to talk about stones. More than just a crevice, it's a crevasse of knowledge on stones in the SGEM, and I know you're going to talk about this later on, but we've done several of these.
We have, and so let's quit talking about the weather, stop the banter. Rachel, get us back on track. Give us a case.
All right. A 45-year-old gentleman presents to the emergency department with sudden onset, severe right-sided flank pain radiating to his groin that began about 1 hour ago. He's also had associated nausea, vomiting, and difficulty urinating. He's never had anything like this before and is writhing around in pain, completely unable to get comfortable.
Well, we know that renal colic affects somewhere between 1% to 5% of the U.S. population. And the typical presentation, like you just presented, is acute, sudden onset of that pain that radiates down from the flank into the groin and the lower abdomen, often accompanied with microscopic hematuria, nausea, and vomiting.
So, Ken, as we discussed, we've talked about a lot of stone issues over the years. And the most recent one, of course, was a good one. That was the diagnostic study looking at CT versus ultrasound for the diagnosis of renal colic or renal stones. And that study was published in New England Journal in 2014. Hard to believe it's already been almost 4 years by Binman et al. And the title of that study was Initial Ultrasonography Was Associated with Lower Cumulative Radiation Exposure Than Initial Computed Tomography Without Significant Differences in High-Risk Diagnosis with Complications, Serious Adverse Events, Pain Scores, Return ED Visits, or Hospitalizations. And I'm sorry that's not the title, but that was the summary findings of that very well-done randomized controlled trial.
See, Rachel, see how he caught himself and self-corrected there? Because I was ready to jump in and say, whoa, those are the conclusions, Tony. And he got the ship back on course. Yeah, those were the conclusions from the study. And we covered it in SGEM number 97, the hippie shake. And our bottom line was bedside emergency department ultrasound is safe and has several advantages over CT for the diagnosis of kidney stones.
Passing a kidney stone is very painful. Narcotics are often used for pain relief, along with IV NSAIDs.
It's points like this that I wish we actually had the video available, and it just wasn't an audio podcast, because people, if you could see the face that Rachel made while she was trying to pass that kidney stone, it was so good, Rachel. Well, we've learned recently about a ceiling effect of ketorolac for treating moderate to severe pain in the emergency department. And that was from that amazing researcher, Sergei Motov. And he showed that 10 milligrams of ketorolac was just as effective as 15 or 30 milligrams IV.
Ken, if I was a researcher, I would change my name to Sergei Motov.
Isn't that a great name?
That's phenomenal. You can't even make that up.
And he's producing such really, really high-quality research. So we love having him on the SGEM and reviewing his papers.
Yeah. Well, so I also need to remind the SGEM fan faithful about the number of times we've talked about alpha blockers to treat renal colic. And there are a fair number of trials here. And if you remember back, SGEM number four. Now, that's early on. I mean, you think about Spider-Man number one is worth, I don't know, a couple hundred thousand dollars, U.S. dollars, which is a couple million Canadian dollars. SGEM number four has to be worth at least 50 cents, I would think.
It's FOMED. I don't think the price changes.
Okay. And so essentially, we really haven't had any high-quality evidence for emergency department patients with renal colic using alpha blockers as a reasonable therapy.
Yeah, we really haven't seen that demonstration of efficacy. And so we covered that three times, and I'll put links to those different episodes in the show notes.
Lidocaine may be a useful alternative, as it has been used effectively to treat visceral and neuropathic pain.
Well, finding non-narcotic alternatives to treating painful conditions is very timely, given the heightened attention to the opioid epidemic in the U.S. So, Tony, what's the clinical question we're going to try to answer today?
In emergency department patients with renal colic, is IV lidocaine as or more effective than IV narcotics for pain control?
And what's the reference, Rachel?
We pulled a paper by Soliamonpour et al. Titled Effectiveness of IV Lidocaine versus IV Morphine for Patients with Renal Colic in the Emergency Department. It was published in the Journal of Urology.
Yeah, and I'm just glad I didn't have to mispronounce that doctor's name. Okay, Tony, you sit back, relax, while Rachel and I do the work, okay? We're going to go through the PICO, we're going to do the quality checklist and the key results, and then we'll bring you back to talk nerdy. Got it?
Absolutely.
All right, so let's run through that PICO. What was the population, Rachel?
The population were patients aged 18 to 65 presenting to the emergency department with unilateral abdominal pain radiating to the genitalia associated with a positive urine analysis for hematuria.
Yeah, and they excluded pregnant patients, if you had an allergy to lidocaine or morphine, a history of renal, hepatic, or cardiac disease. What was the specific intervention?
The intervention was IV lidocaine at 1.5 milligrams per kilogram, but a max of 200 milligrams.
And what did they compare it to?
To IV morphine, 0.1 milligrams per kilogram for a max of 10 milligrams.
And what was their primary outcome?
They measured pain on the VAS at 5, 10, 15, and 30 minutes following the intervention.
And the VAS, that's the visual analog scale. And the author's conclusions were, quote, changing the smooth muscle tone and reducing the transmission of afferent sensory pathways, lidocaine caused a significant reduction in pain. All right, we have 11 questions for the quality checklist for randomized clinical trials. Rachel, are these ED patients?
Yes.
Did they adequately randomize them?
Yes.
Did they conceal the randomization?
Unsure.
Did they analyze the groups to which they were randomized?
Unsure.
Were they recruited consecutively?
Unsure.
Oh, I'm sensing a pattern here. Okay, were both groups similar with respect to the prognostic factors?
Also unsure.
Okay, all participants, were they unaware of group allocation?
We don't know.
Were all groups treated equally except for the intervention?
Unsure.
You know, Rachel, there was this thing a number of years ago, and they were called records. They were about 12 inches. They were made out of vinyl, and sometimes they were break. Yeah, you're sounding like a broken record. Okay,
like one too.
Yeah, now all you have is MP3s, right? Even a CD, Tony, you and I, we had Walkmans. We had Sony Walkmans with a cassette.
I think this is a broken study, Ken, but I may be editorializing.
Yeah, you might be. All right, how about the follow-up? Was it complete?
Unsure.
Oh, stop. Okay. How about all patient important outcomes? Were they considered?
Yes.
All right. And the treatment effect, was it large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant?
We're going to say no.
All right, let's run through those results. They enrolled 240 patients in the study, and they had 120 in each group. The mean age was in the mid-30s. What was the primary outcome?
Less pain with lidocaine than morphine.
Yeah, and if you look at it, 90% of the patients responded to lidocaine successfully versus about 70% of patients responding to morphine.
They also measured secondary outcomes. They looked at the number of patients experiencing side effects, and they said that they were similar between groups.
Yeah, and I just want to note that the trial, it considered accomplished, you know, they accomplished their goal, when either the patient had a pain score of less than 3 on that VAS for 30 minutes after the last analgesic dose, or 10 mLs of the solution in the syringe, so that's either 200 of lidocaine or 10 milligrams of morphine, was used up. It's time to bring Tony back in because it's time to talk nerdy to me. Tony, start it up.
Oh, Ken, what a great lead-in. And let's talk about randomization concealment. And, you know, I got to tell you, when you read this trial, they state they use envelopes. Now, I didn't know they still used envelopes in randomized control trials, but apparently in this one they did. So it's a bit of a throwback. And I'm old school, so I'm good with that. Except for the fact that they really don't do what you need to do for old school concealment using envelopes, and make the simple statement that these envelopes are opaque, that they were not, you know, the seal wasn't broken and all these types of things. None of that was said, which, quite frankly, if you're going to take the time to perform a randomized control trial, you would probably do this. I wonder if they did it at all.
Yeah, you know, you just need them to make that actual statement so that it wasn't some kind of white envelope that they could hold up to a bright light and then introduce some bias. We don't know that. It's just if they had explicitly said that they were opaque, we would feel more confident about that.
Couldn't agree more.
I'd like to talk about intention to treat. There's actually no explicit mention of an intent to treat analysis. The authors note, quote, patients whose pain did not relieve using lidocaine or morphine were administered supplementary drugs. Then, method of drug administration, the reason for prescription, and possible complications were explained to the patients, and it was emphasized that using either lidocaine or morphine is safe. So there is potential for crossover in this trial.
And again, it's just nice to see them explicitly state, we did an intention to treat analysis. And the third thing I want to jump in here with is consecutive patients. There was no discussion made about whether the subjects were recruited consecutively, just that they used randomization.com as the randomization tool. And lack of consecutive recruitment can lead to selection bias.
And Ken, you know, one of the other critical components here is, are we comparing apples to apples? So are the baseline characteristics of patients the same in the experimental group and the control group? And remember, the shortcut for that is to quickly look at table one. And unfortunately, in this trial, we really don't know. As it turns out, it seems as if more patients in the lidocaine group presented with their first stone and less with a recurrent stone. And that may be important because, as you remember, in the number of trials we've reviewed on the use of alpha blockers, size matters. And in this case, the size is 5 millimeters smaller or larger.
So that's a great point about being unsure whether the patients were even similar. But let's talk about whether they even had renal colic. We don't know for sure. They were included based on history and hematuria. Follow-up studies only included a KUB or sonography. Neither of these diagnostic modalities are gold standard methods for diagnosing renal colic. So there's potential for substantial diagnostic bias.
And normally, Tony, you know that I like to go through 5 nerdy points, but I think in this case, this study has something that we can learn from it, and I want to go through some more evidence-based medicine points that I want to highlight. And so, number 6, blinding of patients. It's unclear whether or not all participants were unaware of group allocation. Certainly, morphine can produce side effects that could unmask the blinding. It would have been simple just to ask the participants, hey, which group do you think you were in? We don't know if this potential bias, though, would have favored the morphine group or the lidocaine group.
Yeah, Ken. So to extend on that point, as you know, blinding extends to more than just the patients. So the investigators, the data analysts, even the individuals writing the paper can be blinded to the results and the performance of who's getting what drug in the trial. And in this particular case, it's unclear whether or not the providers were even blinded, because there's certainly a difference in the volume or dose based on weight-based dosing for lidocaine and morphine. And so, you know, as a practicing emergency physician, it's probably going to be pretty easy for me to know if my patient got morphine or lidocaine in this trial. And again, another area where we can have substantial bias.
And number eight, talk about equal treatment. It appears that both groups were treated equally aside from being administered lidocaine versus morphine. However, there's ambiguity in what additional interventions were performed when pain was not adequately controlled. Also, the authors don't even address whether or not the subjects who required additional medications were excluded from the data analysis in the end.
And the ninth point, follow-up. This is not addressed in the article, but it is likely that follow-up was complete due to the short interval of the study.
Yeah, and Ken, I'm going to follow that up with a topic that is near and dear to my heart, and that's statistical versus clinical significance. So the value of P, or the p-value, is oftentimes not very important. And I ask my residents and other colleagues, have you ever discussed a p-value with your patient? The answer, of course not. But what really matters is, was there a clinically significant difference between these two groups? And as it turns out, if you look at the data, it clearly is not the case, because the confidence intervals, which again is another thing that I love to talk about, they overlap between every single one of these groups. If you look at each time point, 5, 10, 15 minutes, 30 minutes, the confidence intervals between the experimental group and the control group overlap. So quite frankly, I think there's no difference.
But Tony, how can you have a urology study that doesn't discuss p-values?
Ken, you got me there, brother.
So Rachel, can you comment on the author's conclusions and compare them to the SGEM's conclusions?
Sure. So the authors have a strong recommendation to use IV lidocaine for renal colic. While lidocaine may work, this trial certainly does not support the strength of their recommendation. The trial suffers from substantial methodologic flaws.
All right, let's turn back to the chairman and say, give us an SGEM bottom line.
So the SGEM bottom line for this segment is that based on this study, lidocaine cannot be recommended for the treatment of renal colic.
Rachel, you started off with a case, so can you give a case resolution?
Absolutely. So the patient had a bedside ultrasound performed by the emergency department physician. It demonstrated mild right-sided hydronephrosis. He was provided with 10 milligrams of IV ketorolac, and his pain resolved. The patient was discharged home with pain control, expectant management, and good instructions on when to return to the ED.
All right, now this is a bit of a higher level question, because we take a step back and we've got this individual study. But Tony, how do we take this individual study and put it into the bigger picture and apply it clinically?
So Ken, you know, obviously we beat this paper up quite a bit, I think, in this episode, but rightfully so. And my hope is that if there truly is a benefit from lidocaine, we'll find this out. Maybe these are just the early studies, and we'll have better studies coming in the next few years. But in terms of clinical application, I've got to be honest and maybe even a little negative here. I think that the authors are overstating the benefit. I, quite frankly, would not recommend this to my patients. I wouldn't even use this as an option, not even in a shared decision-making model, because I'm not convinced. I think there's a little bit too much of a leap here of faith for me to recommend this in my armamentarium of treatments for renal colic, especially when we have well-studied medications that work and are safe. So this article did not provide convincing evidence that lidocaine works, and I'm not even sure that this treatment would be defensible if it was given for renal colic and someone had a bad outcome. People have reported cases of it working beautifully. Of note, there has been a smaller randomized control trial by Farozian et al. In the American Journal of Emergency Medicine, and they looked at IV morphine with and without IV lidocaine and found no statistically significant differences between the groups for the primary outcome, similar to what we reviewed today using a VAS for pain relief. Now, notice I said statistically significant difference versus our clinically significant difference. In this case, if we don't have statistical significance, then there's certainly not going to be clinically significant differences in pain relief. So it too had, however, this trial by Ferozian. It also had methodological issues, but it would be interesting to perform a methodologically rigorous multi-center randomized control trial to tease things out. And Ken, perhaps that's going to happen.
And when it gets published, you know, it's on Renal Colic. I'm going to reach out to you again.
Oh, I will be back. I will be back.
You can't say it like that. You have to say, I'll be back.
I'll be back.
So, Rachel, what are you going to tell your patient?
I would tell him, sir, you have a kidney stone that's causing some mild swelling in your kidney. There does not appear to be any infection at this time. Most kidney stones will pass on their own in about 1 to 2 weeks, but it can be pretty painful. We can treat your pain with some anti-inflammatory drugs. If that does not work, you can also use some opioid pain pills as a backup plan. We will also give you some anti-nausea medications. If your pain is not controlled, you are vomiting, develop a fever, or are otherwise worried, please come back to the emergency department. Otherwise, we will set up an outpatient appointment with a urologist for follow-up.
All right, it's time for the Keener contest, and last week's winner was Marco Civilotti from Queen's University. He knew that it was Sir Charles Simmons who coined the term spontaneous subarachnoid hemorrhage in a seminal paper published in October of 1924. What's the Keener question this week, Rachel?
Who is credited with discovering lidocaine?
Oh, hey, topical. If you know the answer, then send me an email at thesgem@gmail.com. The first correct answer will receive a cool skeptical prize. There's some other FOMED resources out there on IV lidocaine for analgesia and renal colic, and I will list them in the show notes. Tony, thanks for bringing another great resident back on the SGEM.
Ken, it is our honor and privilege to be part of your phenomenal podcast.
Now I'm starting to think I'm going to have to pay you something. Okay, well, Rachel, good luck in the rest of your program. And as the SGEM guest skeptic, you get to give the SGEM tagline.
Thank you so much. It's been really fun. Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next time. Lidocaine.